I'll introduce myself. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm a minister at the church here, and we are delighted to host this event this evening, talking about a couple important issues that are foundational to who we are as a people who elect governing forces. And so we're going to have that kind of as the main topic. Before we formally get started, for those that have not been here before, my wife always tells me to say this: restrooms there, refreshments there, so people know, because sometimes I forget to do that. I cannot stress enough the importance of the conversation tonight and of the material and the education that I will receive and that we will receive. I have, as the minister of this church for the past 6 years, talked a great deal about the space of democracy, of the freedom of speech with real dialogue about who we are as a people, how it seems to me that space is shrinking, and that the space to practice those values that we hold dear as citizens of this country and citizens of this democracy, that those values don't necessarily get attacked directly. Sometimes it seems that the space in which we can practice those values just gets smaller. And that's a passive way of shifting how countries are governed. I would also like to say that the I don't want to appear dramatic. I've been told sometimes I can appear and be dramatic. I once had a supervisor said, "You seem hysterical."
Wait until you get a hold of me.
And I said, "It's because nobody's listening." You get hysterical. But when one form of government is removed and another form of government is installed, some of us call that a war, a battle, a crisis. I call it a war when you remove one way of governing and install another way of governing. Some people say, no, that's how we elect and in fair elections, and that's how we do things. And tonight, the conversation we're going to have, I think, is the most important conversation we can have in this country. And it's not about a variety of issues. It's about one issue. And the issue is who is going to govern this nation? And how is this nation going to be governed? That's the issue that we will talk about tonight. And before we introduce our main speaker, Fred Markham is going to come up and share a few minutes with us about fair and clean elections, something that he's been working on for several years now. And Fred.
Thanks, Gregory. I got interested in clean elections.
It's off, so you need to turn it off.
Turn it off. How do I do that?
Sorry. Yeah, that's it.
You're on. Okay. I got interested in clean elections a few years ago. I can't remember exactly how now. But it just seemed to me that public financing of elections made a lot of sense and could solve a lot of problems, could enable progress that was just stopped on all social fronts. Shortly after I got interested, Harold Phillips came up with the idea of having a civic forum here at the UUCB, it was the 208 election campaign, invited candidates here, let me speak. We had a panel, I don't know, 50 or 60 people came to it, and that was, I thought, very good, a good chance to speak in public and educate the public on what I was beginning to learn about clean elections. And ever since then, if three or four people will sit down, I'll talk to them about clean elections. So thanks for the opportunity tonight just to say a few words. We all know private money is a big problem. Special interest money is a big problem in our government. You wouldn't be here if you didn't know that. I think that the fact of our privately financed political system, all political elections are privately financed, the fact of that causes us to have the kind of government we have today, in which any social reform is extremely difficult to accomplish because those who most need it are the least represented. Those who are the most invested in government because they finance the campaigns believe that they have the least to benefit from such social reforms. Immediately we get something passed like Social Security, like the election era Glass-Steagall reforms that put some reins on the financial system. Immediately we get something passed like that under great crisis situation circumstances. It comes under pressure inevitably because private money is financing the election campaigns, and the only way a person can get elected is to get that private money to pay for his elections. Okay, I believe that this year Florida is maybe one of the worst of the states in terms of special interest money driving the political system, and I believe that this year poses a chance for us to begin to change that. The campaign for Amendments 5 and 6 has been wonderfully run. I think that 5 and 6 are going to pass, and when it does, and removes a little bit, begins to mitigate the gerrymandering in the state, I think within a few election cycles, we can hope to see some beginnings of change in Tallahassee. That can open a door. I want this year to start a campaign for public campaign financing, get a program going that will leverage off of the strength of this Amendment 5 and 6 campaign, get something going that when in the next few election cycles a political opportunity arises, we'll be positioned to take advantage of it. That's what I'm working on this year, beginning after the election, hoping to get some financing for such a campaign. Anybody interested in helping me with that, I'd be glad to talk to you about it. Okay? I'm looking forward to David's words tonight. I know he's got a great talk for us. Thank you.
When I first heard of this movement, Move to Amend, I don't know about you if you've heard of it before, I just went, thank God, you know, finally somebody is doing something coordinated, nationally, trying to organize something to speak about what it means to have the rights of citizens given to corporations. And I don't know if you've read the book by Tom Hartman or how long corporations have been fighting for personhood. It's been 100 years. And with this last decision that corporations can put as much money into that is the almost final kind of final takeover. We certainly know that over 90% of the time, the people that spend the most money to get elected get elected. So wherever the money comes from, whoever puts the most money in, 90% of the time wins. And so I thought, you know, this isn't a new fight. Moses, not David, compare you to Moses at this
That's
point.
That's a hell of a burden you're putting on me, Gregory.
He had a struggle with that too, you know. But his fight was against the moneyed power who structured the economic and labor system. His fight was against that moneyed system. Slave revolts are against money systems. The Civil War of the 1920s, 1930s of the working class people in this country, and it was a civil war. Those people were fighting for better working conditions and a better way of life. What is unique about the day that is different from 1,000-year, 2,000, 3,000-year history of people fighting for better conditions to live under the moneyed class people, what's different today is we're not fighting for that space. We're fighting to defend that space because we have it. We're not trying to get it. We're saying, no, we have it, and we want to keep it. And so when Movement to Amend came back, I said, finally, here's something maybe we can sink our teeth into, maybe we can commit ourselves to, that will make sense. How's it going to happen? How's it going to organize? I know when I first read it, I sent in, whatever you want me to do, I'll do. I don't know whoever read those things. Here's another, you know, nutcase writing this stuff in. So it was wonderful to stay in touch and to have Move to Amend, have that communication come to us and have David Cobb. And I was so grateful when I looked at YouTube and saw you speak and said, yes, I hope he can come to our church and our community to speak. And David Cobb certainly has a resume that is up to the challenge, I think, of what you're doing and what you're trying to organize. And I'm not going to hit what some people might call the high points, but what I like about his resume is that he worked on a shrimping boat. Yeah. That he was a construction worker.
Also true.
And that he was a waiter. Because on those kinds of jobs, what happens when you're a construction worker and you've worked 2.5 hours, you get a 15-minute break, you're sitting around with the other construction workers and you're talking about the struggles of your family, you're talking about your financial troubles, and you're also talking about the ball game, making jokes and making fun of people and all that kind of stuff. But there's some real human encounters and communication that takes place when you're working with the working class people and you're taking breaks with working class people. You get the real feel for the struggles of life. So when I read that about David, I said, wait a minute, maybe this man knows something about those struggles as opposed to having been raised and educated other than that, trying to do a good fight. Maybe this man's got a feel for what working class people go through and what this cause might mean. That's what struck a note for me. Thank you for being here, and we welcome you and eager to listen to what you have to say.
Thank you so much, Gregory. All right. Howdy, y'all. I'm David Cobb. And you know what? In the very back, can y'all hear me? I've kind of got a booming voice. I'll tell you right up front, one of the parts of the resume that Gregory did not tell you is that I'm the grandson of a Baptist preacher. It's true. And so, as they say where I'm from, oftentimes the fruit does not fall far from the tree. And so I have developed, either just by a natural inclination or what have you, I have a booming voice that can reach to the very back of the congregation. And as such, it's actually more comfortable for me not to have to moderate my voice with the microphone. So if anybody can't hear, especially at the back, at any moment, just raise your hand and I'll know what that means. You know, I really appreciate Gregory's introductory comments, and quite explicitly do I appreciate that he focused on my working class background rather than the rest of the high points of my resume. Because I'm going to tell you something right now. The parts that Gregory focused on is who I am. You know, the law school and the running for president, and that's kind of silly, right? I ran for president. That's crazy. You know, although I ran as a Green Party candidate, so that's sort of like running for president. You know, it's very similar to running for president, but I don't know any other presidential candidate who was on the Greyhound bus from one to another. I think I might have been the only one. But the reason I thank Gregory for focusing on that is because it really does speak to who I am and how, in other words, my worldview was shaped by my economic reality. And even though, you know, I was blessed with intelligence. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying that with any pride whatsoever. And if you happen to be one of them people who are real smart, you know, that's great. Don't be proud of it. You didn't do anything for it. The goddess or God or fate or whatever just said, you get to be very smart. You're maybe not so smart. You get to be very clever. You may not be so clever. It doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean you're a good person. You didn't even do anything for it. Right? So don't be particularly smart. Be particularly proud of that. But I will say, in this culture, in this society, actually, if you're clever and if you're willing to work hard, you can get all kinds of benefits. And as a result, I was able to go to school and I waited tables as an undergraduate. And I was able to actually get educated. And the thing is that because I was able to get educated and I got a pair of decent shoes and I got, you know, I could afford a jacket, all I had to do, and watch this. And so I have also trained myself, if I want to actually speak where some non-Southerners might actually listen to me, I have trained myself to speak in such a way dress in such a way that I can go into court anywhere in this country and people will automatically assume that I'm one of them. Well, I ain't one of them. I'm not. I'm a working class fella from San Leon, Texas, who grew up understanding very clearly that the boss has his boot on our neck. And so the interesting thing for me, Gregory, is that I came from a place to fight to get someplace, and now that I'm here, you damn right I'm going to fight to keep it. Right? I wasn't born into that. I did struggle for it, and now that I've got it, I'm going to fight like hell to keep it. And so, a way to start the whole conversation, my name is David Cobb. I am a proud, patriotic, and these days I am a pissed off American citizen. You can applaud that. I hope you're pissed off too. I do. And I'll tell you something. I really wish that progressives would actually get comfortable with our sense of righteous indignation. You know, that there is a reason that we're angry. And that anger actually comes from a place of righteousness. You know, and because we're in a Unitarian Universalist church, and I guess this is, as my grandfather, the Baptist preacher, would say, it's almost a church. You know? Very, very similar. Y'all don't have the crucifix up, but God, otherwise it looks and feels just like a church. Almost a church. So as a place that's more or less a church, let's just agree right now, this is going to be a truth-telling zone, okay? Can we agree? Yes. It'll call and response. Can we agree?
Yes.
All right, so the truth. Here's the thing. Here's the truth. I believe that we live in a racist, sexist, and class-oppressive country. All right, well, there's a call and response. Amen. Right? We got to tell the truth. And here's another truth. I'm angry that progressives don't express their anger. Why is it that the Tea Party are the only people who get to claim to be angry? Well, I'm angry too. And you know what's really funny? I'm also angry about Wall Street America and the big corporations and the banksters. Which is interesting. Yeah, you can applaud that too. And isn't it interesting that so much of the rhetoric that often comes out of some of the Tea Party folks actually is that same kind of thing? Well, they're not the only ones who get to claim to be angry at Wall Street and the bankers. And in fact, I'll tell you something. On the left, progressives, we've actually been angry about that for a lot longer than the Tea Party has. So not only is our anger from a place of righteousness, but we've got legacy. We got pedigree. You know? And I'll tell you, even deeper, I'm also angry because I can remember what it was like to be a proud and patriotic American without any qualifiers. See, I see the heads nod. It was when I was a little boy, when I was taught that I was from the land of the free and the home of the brave. And not only that, but I was from a land of liberty and justice and equality. And I was so proud to be from that country. Do y'all remember that too? I was so proud to be from that country. And not only was I from the land of liberty and justice and equality, but my country was like the great shining light on the hill. And it would guarantee and bring liberty and justice and equality to the whole rest of the world. I was so proud to be from that country. And as a little boy, I didn't understand all the implications of that. I didn't understand exactly what that meant. But at my gut level, my heart level, what I knew that meant was that my country was fair. That my country was good. And that my country was decent. And I was so proud to be that way. And I am angry because I grew up and I realized I had been lied to. And the thing is, as I thought about this, I have to acknowledge and understand that lie was a complicated lie, because it wasn't the kind of lie that a used car salesman might tell you. You know, Mrs. Armstrong was my fifth grade teacher, the first one who started to tell me about how civics worked in government. And I can actually remember her. And you know, I don't think that Mrs. Armstrong stood up at night and said, I can't wait till those children come into class tomorrow so I can fill their minds full of lies and propaganda. No, no, no. Mrs. Armstrong was not like that. She was a sweet and loving woman. She became an elementary school teacher, I am sure, because she loved children and she wanted to teach them, right? That's why she did it. If there's any educator, or especially a public school educator in this crowd, let me just say thank you. Thank you. And I mean that sincerely. And thank you to Mrs. Armstrong. Here's the thing, y'all. Mrs. Armstrong was so effective as a teacher because she believed what she was telling me. And it worked so well on me because I wanted to believe it. And the reason that and let's call it what it is, the creation myth of liberty, justice, and equality. The reason that creation myth works so well is because all of us want to believe it. We all want desperately to live in liberty and justice and equality. And may I submit to you that all of us want that, not because we're Americans, but because we're human beings. And frankly, Rwandan children want that too. And Chilean children want that. And Finnish children. And Iraqi children. And everybody wants that. Right? That drive that we have is something that we want so desperately to be true, and that's the reason that the ruling elites from time immemorial will create creation myths around what it is to tell us what they think that we need to hear in order to keep us basically obedient. Although it's interesting because if you go back far enough, Gregory is right, of course, that before there was just a brutal kind of oppression. And so people fought up against that out of a kind of rage against the boot on their neck. We are unique in this country, I think, in that we were taught a creation myth of our freedom and liberty. And isn't it something that so many Americans will go around talking about how free they are without ever knowing what it's like in, say, Europe or other parts of the world? It's kind of interesting. So, you know, I said earlier that this would be a truth-telling zone, and I called out racism and sexism and classism, and I do think that we need to tell the truth, and so I also want to tell this truth. Corporations, specifically the huge transnational corporations, are not merely exercising power today. They are ruling us. As surely as masters once ruled their slaves, or kings once ruled their subjects, unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are ruling over us. They are making the fundamental public policy decisions that affect all of our lives. And here's a quick little pop quiz for you. How many people here are eating genetically mutated organisms in your food on a daily basis? I saw this guy didn't blink an eye. He raised his hand immediately. How come? Why are you eating that? Can you be sure?
You can't escape it.
You can't escape it. I knew I'd get the right answer. That's right. So check it out. We can't escape it. Why? Because it's in our public food supply. Virtually every food that's available for purchase today on American shelves contains GMOs. But here's a question, and you basically already answered it. But who made that public decision to put GMOs in our public food supply? Monsanto Corporation and Archer Daniels Midland Corporation and Pioneer Hybrid Corporation. Here, you can go down the list, right? But here's the thing. The unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs of private corporations made that decision. It's a public policy decision, but they claim this is a private decision. So they're allowed to make it behind closed doors, and we the people didn't even know that decision was being made, much less were we allowed to participate in making that decision. And I tell you that we can actually look at our healthcare choices, and I'll tell you that your access to healthcare, or ever more, your lack of access to healthcare, is being dictated by corporate CEOs. What transportation choices you have available to you are being made by corporate CEOs. What kind of pension plan you may have and evermore do not have are being made by corporate CEOs. How much air or how much pollution will be the air that you breathe? How much pollution will be in the water that you drink? Literally, point after point after point, The real decisions about this country are being made by these corporate CEOs, and we the people are being left to choose between paper or plastic at the grocery store, Coke or Pepsi. We don't have any meaningful role in actually dictating the terms of our lives. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. This is the United States. Mrs. Armstrong told me this was a democracy. So I have to ask, all right, time out, wait a minute. If this is a democracy, then let's just ask ourselves, what does that word mean? Anybody know what language democracy comes from?
Greek.
So let's break it down. Demos? What does demos mean?
People.
The people. What does kratia mean?
Power
or rule. It can translate either way. But basically it means the people rule or the people have the power. If we the people actually had power, if we the people were actually ruling ourselves, wouldn't we be able to implement and create the world we want to live in? Because the reality is that the majority of Americans want access to health care. Poll after poll after poll shows that they agree with us, yet we don't have it. The overwhelming majority of Americans want the troops, our troops, brought back from Iraq and Afghanistan. That's what the majority wants. And yet the bombs continue to fall to this day. The majority of Americans want to see us transition off of the fossil fuels that are leading global climate crisis and actually transition into sustainable energy choices. You look at poll after poll after poll and you see, and here's a big secret, you members, your positions are majority positions. So take a moment and bask in that a little bit, but don't take too much time. Because even though the majority agrees with us, none of the policies of this country reflect our values. So I say bask in it, but also realize it means we've got work to do. We got some serious work to do. Because we don't have a democracy. And I do believe that corporations are the reason that we don't have a democracy, not a functioning democracy. And so now I'll ask us to turn our attention to the word corporation itself. What language is corporation from?
Latin.
It is from Latin, sir. Does anybody know what corporation means in translation?
Body.
Body, or corpus is body, and corporation is the state of having a body. Right? To give body to or to have a body. And the reason that that is a Latin word, by the way, is because the first corporations ever created by humans was in the Roman Republic. And I want to be clear, it was the Roman Republic and not the Roman Empire. And I got to tell you, there's a big part of me that says, I wish we had enough time to really investigate what happens when a country goes from being a republic to an empire. Because there's some very important lessons there. But just flag that and let's think about that. Maybe Gregory will invite me back and we can explore that sometime. But let's just think about the corporation comes out of the Roman Republic. Well, why? You know, I'm a lawyer. Any other lawyers in the crowd that admit it? There's one that like. Do you remember in law school? I remember very specifically being taught a corporation is a legal fiction. Does that ring a bell for you? It's a legal fiction. You know why they tell us that? Because they say it doesn't really exist, but we're going to pretend like it exists so that we can treat it under law and so forth. And here's the amazing thing. Because we act like it exists, even though it doesn't exist, presto changeo, it exists. How did the first corporations come into being? How did they give body to? What was the function of it? Well, they said, we want to build an aqueduct system. You know that amazing bit of engineering marvel that moved water all across the Italian peninsula? Well, that aqueduct system was built by corporations. The very famous Roman Colosseum, the ruins of which still stand to this day, that Colosseum was built by corporations. The first universities ever created, corporations. The first hospitals, corporations. So does anybody see anything that those things have in common? A water system, an arena, universities, hospitals. They're all public goods. And several of you said public. That's right. They're public goods. But check it out. What makes it like public projects have been carried out for millennia. But the difference was the Roman Republic thought of something that I think is actually quite clever and actually quite good, which is the idea of taking private investors and asking them, not mandating, but asking them to invest in this public project. For example, go to Fred and say, Fred, would you be willing to invest in our effort to build a road? And he could say, so he says, yes. Gregory, would you be willing to invest in this effort? Bill, where are you? We talked earlier. Where's Bill? Bill's right here. Would you be, say no, Bill.
No,
he said. To which we say, okay, Bill, calm down. Keep your damn money. And we'll find somebody else. Tim, how about you?
Yes.
See, Bill, I don't need your money. But the reason that the corporation was unique was because before that, when public projects were being financed by private money, it was to say, Fred, we are taxing you. Gregory, we are taxing you. Bill, we are taxing you. Don't tell me no, or we'll send the centurions after your ass. You see the difference? The idea of the corporation at its root was to take private money and in a voluntary way entice them to invest in an effort to do a public project. And how do we entice them? By saying, we're going to give you a return on your investment. It's an investment, Gregory. We're going to pay you back for this. Not just an altruistic sense of, at the end of it, say, well, look at that aqueduct system that I helped to build. No, we're going to give you some money back. We're going to give you the money that you put in plus some. We've got a situation, an idea to do it. So don't you see that I want to be very clear about this. If anybody says, David Cobb is anti-corporation, no, I am not. I am actually very much a supporter of the appropriate use of the corporate form. And I believe that using public projects and accomplishing public goods is a very good way to organize capital. Right? A very good way to organize capital. But now we got to admit, that is not exactly what the modern transnational corporation does today, is it? No, sir. And so now, just in the spirit of the genesis of the original corporations of Rome, we have to ask ourselves, what's the genesis of the modern transnational corporation? Well, now, let's jump forward in world history to the 13th, 14th, and 15th century of Europe. That is the age of discovery. Right? I have to put discovery in quotation marks, right? Because what did they discover? Well, Africa, Asia, later North and South America. Newsflash, there were people living there. They were not lost. They did not need to be discovered. In fact, since, as I said, this was a truth-telling zone, the truth of the matter is the 13th and 14th and 15th century of Europe was the age of murder and rape and oppression and violence. It was the age of, that's what colonialism means. In fact, let's put a fine point on it and really tell the truth and call it what it really is, empire. It is empire. It was the age of empire where military was sent outside to rape, pillage, and plunder and then steal resources from Africa, Asia, later North and South America, and vacuum those resources out. And check it out. The corporation, the modern transnational corporation, was created for the first time at that time to facilitate that theft and murder. That was the entire point of it. And I mean that very specifically. For example, the Dutch East Indies Corporation, one of the very first corporations, it was specifically created in order to legitimize and legalize the military conquest of the area later known as Indonesia and legalize the murder of those human beings there and then stealing their land. Another great corporation at the time was called the Africa Trading Company. Does anybody want to hazard a guess what the Africa Trading Company traded? Slaves, but somebody else said another word.
People.
Thank you. Africans. Right? And the reason that I think that it's so important, because if we just say slaves, that abstracts it somehow. You know? I like it whenever people say Africans are people, because it really underscores, and stay with me, people that were virtually just like us. Stay with me here. I see a couple of heads nodding. You already see where I'm going with this, I think. Because people like us, at the scientific level, at the DNA level, people exactly like us. And here's something for the white racists. I reckon there probably we don't have a big high percentage of them in this particular crowd. But I'd love to tell David Duke, for example, hey pal, guess what? You're from Africa. Because we all are, right? I mean, so at the one level, humanity itself is actually birthed out of Africa. Every anthropologist learns that, and it's scientifically true. It's objectively true. But even deeper than that, people just like us, because scientists of today will tell you there is no such thing as race. There is literally no such thing as race. Now, there's clearly such a thing as pigment. I mean, several of us just have different skin tones, right? So the pigment associated with our skin definitely is real. Hair color is real. Well, I mean, I have a memory that hair color is real. I look out amongst you and I see that Gregory has a different hair color than Fred has, right? Eye colors are real. Like, there's differences, but to elevate those kinds of differences to taxonomy, no scientist would let you get away with that. That's just stupid. That's just plain stupid. They would say that doesn't make any sense at all. And so race is a construct. It gets created. It doesn't exist. But check it out. Race isn't real, but racism is. Race isn't real, but racism is. Why? Because even though race doesn't exist in reality, we all act like it does. And you know what happens? Presto, chango! Race exists. It's real. Even though it's not real, we make it real by the way we think and talk about it. So the question is, why do we think and talk about it like that? Whenever people before us did not? Well, in order to justify slavery. Here's an example. Because slavery had existed a long time before. I mean, Gregory talked about the pharaohs of Egypt, and they enslaved people, right? We know that. But even before Egypt and that area, slavery as a concept had been utilized and practiced. Anthropologists know this for a fact. But here's the thing. Back then, it would go like this. My tribe goes to war against Gregory's tribe. My tribe wins. I put my spear up against Gregory's throat, and I say, "You're my slave." We even speak the same language. We're basically, the only thing separating us is a river right now. We're basically the same people, a different tribe. I got the spear against his throat. You're my slave. Now, let me ask you something. In this circumstance where I've got the spear up against Gregory's throat, what's the philosophical justification for my right or authority to enslave Gregory?
The spear.
Power, military. There's nothing, sir, there is, at this point I'm making, under this, no philosophical, I don't even try to pretend as if there's any justification for it. Might makes right, somebody said. Right? Well, it doesn't. She said, no, it hasn't. Good for you. But my justification is nothing more than military might, or the spear. But around the 14th and 15th century, race gets created in order to justify the idea of enslaving a whole group of people for no other reason than pigment. Right? The idea of saying that it is justifiable, in fact, is allowable under ethics and the law to justify the enslavement of Africans, even though they're human beings, is how I say, actually, they're not human beings. That we're going to create a whole other thing called race, and they're an inferior race. You see what I'm getting at? I guess the point I'm making is to be very clear that the birth of the modern transnational corporation is not only directly an instrument of imperialism and imperial conquest, but also is at the root of racism itself. And that they are inextricably tied, and no less an ethical or philosophical teacher than the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. made the connection between militarism and racism. And he was right. So the use of the corporation as an instrument of empire and an instrument of race, let's keep it in our mind as we say, fast forward the history now to the United States of America. How many original colonies here? 13. How many of those, and by the way, they're colonies, colonialism, imperialism, worth remembering. How many of those originally 13 colonies do you think actually were corporations?
All of them.
Because it wasn't originally the state of Massachusetts or the Massachusetts Commonwealth. In its first creation, it was the Massachusetts Bay Trading Colony. Virginia did not begin as the state of Virginia. It began as the Virginia Company. It was a Providence and Rhode Island plantation. Georgia started as a penal corporation named after King George. By the way, what color do you think the first slaves who worked the Georgia Penal Corporation was? What pigment do you think they had?
White.
Say it louder, Fred.
White.
They were white. Why? Because, and this is also important for us to understand from a historical perspective, because up until around the 1400s, 1500s in England, all of the people were indigenous. So if you come from English stock, you come from an indigenous history. Actually, we all come from an indigenous history. That's the secret. So we come from an indigenous stock, which simply means that the people at that time were living indigenously to the land, and that they were actually getting their sustenance from the land. They were farming, they were fishing, they were hunting, they were gathering, they were engaged in horticulture. They didn't own that land. The land owned them. And that's actually how they thought about it. Until the king comes along, the sovereign, you know, the one who the rest of the world was creating these transnational corporations, where at home, what the king did, the sovereign, and what does sovereign mean, by the way? The word? Ruler, the ruler, who rules. So the sovereign of the day simply said, I'm going to enclose these areas, these forests, and exclude other people. You know, remember from law school, the first right of property is the right to exclude? Well, that comes out of that tradition. Just simply wall it off and kick the people out, the people who up until that point had depended upon access to those forests, those streams, for their very livelihood and their very existence. They can no longer access it, so now they must become wage slaves to the growing mercantile system that is sweeping across England at the time. And so what do they have? If they can't get a wage slave job, they might actually get grabbed up and literally put in either debtor's prison or get sent to Australia or Georgia to work as a slave. That's literally the history here, right? And so the very first slaves working in Georgia were actually white slaves. Now, of course, we've talked about the king a couple of times, and you know, thank goodness it was an American Revolution, and that's something we should applaud and be happy about. I used to always say the American revolutionaries were not calling for a more socially responsible king, and so too today should we not merely call for more socially responsible corporations. We should aim our aspirations a little higher, you know? But what's interesting is what I realized is actually the people who became revolutionaries actually were originally calling for more socially responsible king. And how do I know that? Because the letters that they were writing in the 1750s and the 1760s went like this. And this is virtually a direct quote. Dear Father King, we, your humble and obedient children, come before you on bended knee to ask that you intervene on our behalf, because the Parliament and the governors of your colonies are oppressing us mightily with unfair laws like the Navigation Act and the Stamp Act and other laws that are treating us unfairly. And we, your obedient English children, ask that you intervene on our behalf, Father. And it went from that kind of sniveling, groveling, obsequious language in one generation to get out. And I tell you something, man, as somebody who proclaims proudly to be a revolutionary, a nonviolent revolutionary, but a revolutionary and doesn't make any bones about it, I am keenly interested in what it takes for a people to stop bootlicking. To get up off their knees and stand up and put their shoulders back, their chin up, fix their gaze on the king, you know, the sovereign king who has the right to rule, and look at the king and look behind the king at the most powerful military empire the world had ever seen and say, you're done. That's courage. That's not just courage, that's conviction. And not just conviction, that is a sense of self-respect that I am so hungry to be part of. And frankly, I think that's the kind of liberty and justice and equality that we so desperately want to be from. That's the history and the legacy that we want to capture and understand. And so, when the American revolutionaries kick out the king, the person who up until that point had actually been the ruler, the sovereign, then a new government, like a new government actually has to get created, right? Because now the king is gone. And by the way, we've been talking about the king and being sovereign. Where does the king up until this point get his legitimacy?
God.
Let me tell you something, sister. You do not get more legitimate. You know what I'm saying? I mean, if you really believe, and most importantly, if everybody else agrees that your power, your legitimacy comes from God, you don't get more legitimate. I'm going to do a thought exercise with you. This is always fun, at least for me. I'm going to ask you to close your eyes with me, and you don't have to say it out loud, but just repeat it in your head after I do. David Cobb is the king. Told you it'd be fun for me. David Cobb is the king, and as the king, he is God's representative on earth. And therefore, everything David says must be obeyed as if it were from God. David Cobb is the king, and as the king, he is God's representative on earth. And therefore, everything David says must be obeyed as if God has spoken. David Cobb is the king. Okay, open your eyes. How many of you bought that? Nobody, right? You know why? Because it's nuts! Right? I mean, that's beyond far-fetched. That's crazy talk. I mean, that's full-on crazy talk. But here's the thing. 500 years ago, virtually the entire society believed it. The reason that I'm making a big deal about that is to really underscore the depths to which people's core belief system can change. From the very creation of race, to the idea of legitimacy of governing authority itself. I mean, that's deep, right? That's way deeper than the day-to-day stuff of healthcare or so forth. That's deep, deep, deep. And the fact is that just not in terms of archaeologic time, a blink of an eye, a few generations, and to Nobody today would make the argument that virtually the entire society all agreed upon before. So when we're told that you can't change anything, the hell you say? History is replete with profound kinds of changes like that. You know, it is in fact our birthright to make demands for changes like that. And so we know that the king was the legitimate ruling authority at one time in this country, but the king gets kicked out and we create a new governing structure. And so the charter for that new governing structure, here, maybe I'll move this up here so everybody can see it. Can y'all see that?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So the new governing structure is the supreme law of the land. And what is that? Say it loud. The U.S. Constitution. Now, the U.S. Constitution, we are taught, is the supreme law of the land. It's the charter of the United States. Just like corporations are issued a charter to come into being, the Constitution brings into being the governing structure of this country. These are, if you will, the operating instructions for how our country is supposed to operate or be governed. So let's actually try to understand this. Now, how many people here have read the Constitution in the last year or so? Raise your hand. 2 years. I'll get Max 2 years. Get a hand from you? All right. So a couple of hands come up. So see if I got this right, more or less. I'm going to submit to you that there are two major actors in the U.S. Constitution. The first major actor is the most important one. It's the first three words of the U.S. Constitution. We the people. Hallowed words in this country, and they should be. And hallowed, by the way, not just by Christians or believers, hallowed words by everyone who purport to be believers in the idea of the United States and what it's supposed to stand for. We the people, the other great actor, is what we the people create through this Constitution, which is government itself. We the people in this document are described as being free and sovereign. And what does sovereign mean again? the ruler. We rule, and we are free because we are not enslaved. We are in liberty. Government in this document is described as being subordinate and accountable. Government is subordinate to whom?
The people.
The people. Government is accountable to whom?
The people.
The people. I like how this is going. It kind of has a ring to it. We the people are free and sovereign. Government is subordinate and accountable. And according to this framework, we the people are described and understood to have individual rights. Government is described as having collective duties. Now, what's especially interesting to me about this is that the rights that the people have actually precede the Constitution. Stated another way, the Constitution doesn't create any rights at all. The Constitution recognizes rights. And you know what kind of rights those are? Belly button rights. We have our rights because we're human beings. That's what it means when you say we are created, we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. Inalienable means that these are rights that you have that you cannot lose, that no legitimate authority can take away from you. You have them because you're a human being, period, end of story. We have individual rights. And if you have a right to do something, it means you can do it, end of story. And you don't need government permission to do it. Likewise, if you have a duty, it means you have to do it. And if I owe, for example, if I owe Fred a duty and I try to refuse to do it, I don't have the right to refuse. He can, in fact, get the rest of you through society to force me through the civil system, the civil justice system, or the criminal justice system if necessary, and force me to do it. So the difference between rights and duties is very profound. And by the way, under this framework, government never has rights against the people. Never. And the people don't have duty to government, not a legal duty to government. Except for, the point is that we the people are not supposed to be afraid of our own government. Government is supposed to be afraid of the people. That's the way this is supposed to work. And I look at this and I think, I love this. This framework is absolutely brilliant. And I love it because it understands that in the private sphere, when I'm acting truly in my private capacity with individual rights, I am sacrosanct. I am like a king. You can't push me around. I can think what I want to think. I can say what I want to say. I can associate with who I want to associate with. And in fact, isn't it interesting that all of those things that I just described are specifically enumerated in the Bill of Rights to make it clear that I have the right to do those things and government cannot interfere with it. But, you know, so it satisfies my civil libertarian impulses. My civil libertarian impulses are satisfied by this idea. But and unlike our capital L libertarian friends, I recognize that it doesn't end there because there's also a public component to this entire framework. That my communitarian ethic is also satisfied here. Because although individually I have rights that can never ever be trampled upon, it's no man is an island or no person is an island. We actually, everything that we do ultimately has a public component to it. And certainly whenever we gather together collectively, there is a public thing. And therefore, I don't have the right to shout fire in a crowded theater. I don't have the right to pollute a stream because a stream is a public good that we all take advantage of. I don't have the right to pollute the airwaves, the air with toxic poisons because we all publicly breathe that air, and I would submit we don't actually have the right to pollute the public broadcast airwaves with messages of hate and violence because that is not a right. But I digress. I look at this and I think this really is brilliant. I do love this. We should try that in this country. I think this would work, and I am not even joking, y'all. This is a brilliant philosophical way to organize ourselves to protect individual rights of human beings and understand that there is a public component to it. And that's the point. We've never actually tried that in this country. Because before I go 1 second further waxing poetic about the brilliance of the U.S. Constitution, somebody tell me at what year the Constitution was either drafted or ratified. 1776 is the Declaration. 1780. She said, like, I know the answer. And she's right. 1789 is the U.S. Constitution ratified. 1787 was the Constitutional Convention, for those of you keeping score at home on your baseball cards. 1789, it's ratified. So, what group of human beings were actually legally persons that could wrap themselves in this brilliant document?
Men.
Men and men only, not women. So, women, not people.
Property.
You had to be property. You had to literally own property and be actually somewhat wealthy.
You were white.
You had to be white. So you had to be white, you had to be a man, you had to own property.
Pay a certain amount of taxes, not just own property too.
You had to pay a certain amount of taxes, so the level of class distinction to be legally a person, parse it out. There's another one that oftentimes people don't think about. You had to be in the right religion. If you were not in the right religion, you could not actually, in many places, you couldn't sue, you couldn't own property. I mean, there are all sorts of restrictions. So here's a question for you. What percentage of the adult population? Adult population. I'm not even talking about the children, but the adult population. What percentage of the adult population do you think were legally persons under this definition? 20%?
10%?
5%? The answer? Approximately 5 to 8%. Of the entire adult population actually were legally persons under this framework whenever it was first proposed. So let's just be very clear about this. The U.S. Constitution, for all its beauty and elegance, in practice, upon its founding, is a founding violence. It's a founding violence, obviously, against the indigenous human beings who already lived here, who were subject to intentional, deliberate, genocidal policies. You know, murder. It's a founding violence against the Africans who were brought at the point of a spear or the barrel of a gun and forced to build this country with slave labor. And it's also a founding violence against the women, all of the women, because no woman was legally a person. She could not vote, or could she enter into contracts. She couldn't even own property in her own name. In fact, she was property. By every reasonable understanding of that, literally was the property of either her father or her husband, and then later even her sons or uncles. We the people was a very tightly controlled terminology. And also, folks, it's a founding violence against the white men, or the overwhelming majority of the white men, who were equally disenfranchised because they didn't pay enough taxes, because they didn't own enough property, whoever said property, because they weren't actually part of the ruling elite. And if you take the number of, like, that's 5 to 8% who were legally persons. If you actually ask how many of them actually were really in positions of true governing power in this country, what you realize is it was a ruling elite from the get-go, from the jump. So there's a founding violence here. Now, some people might say, all right, Cobb, you got a scathing critique about ancient world history and imperialism and colonialism. You've got a critique against the founding of this country, but get over yourself. We got rid of slavery. Women can vote. We've actually solved everything. So now we actually have a functioning democracy. To which I say, au contraire, mon frère. Because now it's time to reintroduce the corporation. And by the way, persons or people used repeatedly throughout this document. How many times do you think the word corporation appears in the Constitution?
Zero.
Not a single time. Zero, as this woman is saying. Zero. You're right, sister. Zero. That might suggest to us that the founders did not expect the corporation to play any meaningful role in the body politic. And, you know, for those people who are constantly saying, we got to know the founder's original intent, what people I call founder fetishists, you know, those people, you know, like Alito and Roberts and Scalia, why don't you actually apply a little intellectual honesty? Can I just go on one quick little diatribe? I am sick and tired of the right-wing justices and their hypocrisy. I am just sick and tired of the hypocrisy. They claim that there is some sort of devotion to the founder's original intent, but they don't actually look to the founder's original intent. They claim that there is a commitment to stare decisis, or this idea of settled law ought to stay settled. They claim that there is a commitment to judicial restraint, and that they will allow the legislature to actually represent the people, and yet they overturn laws repeatedly that the legislature actually enacts. The right-wing court are a bunch of liars. And I think that we need to actually say that. Go ahead, Warren.
Original founders established the Supreme Court to protect the country from democracy.
Well, there you go. Well, we're getting to that. Here's the point. James Madison, the father of the Constitution, actually said the people who own the country ought to govern it. So this is the point. This is the creation myth. We are told that this is the way it was created, but in implementation, it was not true. But here's the thing. As we say where I'm from, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. The bathwater, of course, is the racism and the sexism and the class oppression that is the reality of the founding of this country. But the baby is precious. The baby are the concepts that we were taught. So here's the thing. I can accept the fact that there may not be an Easter bunny. I can get my head around no tooth fairy, but damn it all, this is a promise that was made to me as a little boy that I intend to make real. This is worth saving, not even saving. This is worth creating, because we never actually had it as a functioning democracy, but we deserve it. And so I said it's time to reintroduce the corporation. So we didn't have actual democracy from the founding of this country, and we never did, because the Constitution is set up to protect the property rights of the ruling elite. But it's sold as if it is democracy. That's the selling point. Read the Federalist Papers. That's the entire way that they try to convince it. That's the language that they use. Right? Now, I said I wanted to reintroduce the corporation. Does anybody know what it actually takes to actually create a corporation in the state of Florida today? $50. I think it's $150, actually. $150, and you sign a piece of paper, send it to the Secretary of State. You know what the Secretary of State will do?
Take your money,
cash your check, and then send you articles of incorporation. Do you know how long your corporation can exist?
Forever.
You know what you can do with your corporation? Anything that you're legally allowed to do. Some of us will argue, including things you're not legally allowed to do. Do you know what it took to form a corporation in 1789 for the first 75 years of this country? Watch this. You had to get a bill introduced in the lower house, and that bill had to pass by 50%. And then that bill had to go to the upper house, and it had to pass by 50%. And then what had to happen? The governor had to sign it. It was literally the functional equivalent of passing a law. And anybody who's tried to lobby and get laws passed, you know how much care that takes, right? And catch this. Through the process of applying for the privilege, not the right, but the privilege of incorporation, you had to prove that there was a public need that was not being met either by existing private enterprise or government institutions. And you had to pledge to always act in the public interest while you did that very specific thing. And lastly, it only lasted for 10 years. At which point it automatically dissolved, and you had to go through the process all over again. It is amazing the degree to which the corporation was very tightly controlled. Now, I'm not suggesting that this was a land of milk and honey for African slaves or for workers or for women. What I'm saying is this. The corporation as an entity for the first 75 years is tightly controlled because the ruling elite was using slavery and patriarchy and other institutions to control the overwhelming masses. All I'm saying is this. If this framework makes sense, if this accurately describes what we're taught we're supposed to have, and it does, and if I'm right that this line is important, that there's a difference between we the people and government and being free and sovereign and subordinate and accountable, if I'm right about that, and I am, then we have to ask, where should a corporation go? And the answer is, it is created by state government that issues its charter. That charter can make it accountable and it can be revoked. That is, the corporate charter revocation could happen anytime a corporation acts outside the public interest. The corporation, properly understood, should be, needs to be, must be on this side of the line. So when the court, unelected and unaccountable institution that it is, says no, a corporation is a person with constitutional rights, it perverts the entire premise of a democratic republic. Corporate personhood is not just an idea that should concern lawyers. If you believe that we the people have the sovereign right to govern ourselves, then you have to be against the idea of corporate constitutional rights. Because a corporation that can claim constitutional rights can march into court and have lawyers argue that any law that was passed that attempts to control their harm or abuse violates the corporation's constitutional rights. And in fact, environmental protection laws have been overturned by corporate lawyers claiming that their constitutional rights are violated. Worker protection laws have been routinely overturned by courts who say that corporations' constitutional rights are violated. Consumer safety and health laws have been routinely overturned because corporate lawyers argue that their constitutional rights are being violated. The reality, and of course most recently in the Citizens United case, campaign finance laws were overturned because corporations claimed that their First Amendment rights to free speech were being violated. Ya basta. Enough already. This has gone too far, hasn't it?
Yes.
This has gone too far. It's time for we the people to get up off our knees, to stand up, put our shoulders back, put our chin up, look at corporate America and say, you're done. Enough. And that's why at Move to Amend, we are calling for a nonviolent revolution in this country where we the people will assert our sovereign right to self-governance and make the promise of democracy a reality. Peace.
Thank you. Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Listen, y'all.
Thank you so much for that. And I hope I, 45 minutes, right? I wanted to end in enough time to make absolutely sure that we've got time for comments and questions. So the first thing I'm going to do is this, is to ask if you would just take one of these and pass it. Take one and pass it. This is our introductory brochure that I hope all of you will go home with and look at. And even if you didn't agree with me, and I got to say, I saw a lot of heads nod yes for y'all not to agree with me. The second thing I'm going to do is this. I'm going to pass this around. If you agree with me enough, the way Gregory did, to want to actually get involved and be in touch with us, please sign. And this is not, by the way, a traditional petition. I'm not even going to pretend, Max, that we're going to get 100,000 names and present it to anybody. No. We are organizing ourselves. This is an organizing list. So, and what is it, about every 3 to 4 weeks you get an email from us, Gregory? It's not going to inundate you, but we will let you know what we're doing. For example, the Koch brothers, MT Mutha, and then put something out on our list to expose them for who and what they are. You know, we will put out information to you about what we're doing, what we're up to, and the fact is 90,000 other Americans have already signed up. Right? Corporate media has never covered us a single time, and yet we're on the move. So I'm going to ask if you would be willing to join us. If you don't want to, hey, pass it. I won't have my feelings hurt. I will beg you, if you're going to sign it, print legibly. That's all I'm asking of you. Print legibly.
Always restrictions.
Always restrictions more than
that. When you deal with lawyers.
The second thing I'm going to ask, Gregory, how much money did I charge you to come here today?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. So this is the Unitarian Church, and now since I'm going to do this, I'm going to say, oh, this is a church, all right. Before I was like, maybe a church. Now that I'm going to ask for money, it's a church. These baskets are empty right now. What I'm asking you to do is to put some money in. And because literally, and I'm going to ask you, look, I'm not going to say give till it hurts, because I don't want anybody to hurt, really, but I'm going to say this sincerely. Please be generous. And I mean that really. Like, honestly, y'all, I came to from Boca Raton. People drove up in Lexuses and Cadillacs and dropped a $5 bill in here. And I was shocked, actually. It's like, I'm asking you to please be generous to make this movement go. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I make 15% of the money I made as a practicing lawyer. I qualify for food stamps. And I say that not so that you'll feel sorry for me. I say that so you will put some money in here. Okay? So please actually be generous as this comes around.
We call it a love offering.
A love offering. Show me some love, y'all. And here's the second thing, as that goes around, thank you, Gregory, for that. I'm going to ask if any of you would like to ask a question or make a comment to the rest of the congregation here, just raise your hand and we'll call on you. But show everyone else, like, oh, come on, not everyone. Y'all are just done? This is...
So what's your next...
All right, so Fred, you'll be number one. Anybody else? I'm just trying to see if there's... Nobody? Just Fred. All right, so sir, you'll be number two. Tim, you're three. Sir, you're number four. I knew if I prodded y'all that there were people who wanted to speak. So, you know, huh? You might have a relationship with him. See, I pay attention. So, sir, you'll be number five. And hey, and Warren, you'll be number six. You're number six. All right, and so here's the thing, y'all. This will only work if you remember your number, right? And the reason I do this is numbers 2 through 6, now you don't have to worry. You're going to get to make your comment or ask your question. But instead, do like the rest of us are going to do and actually pay attention to number 1. Fred.
So,
stand up, that's right.
So I'm just curious what your next step, your first step, I guess, for this constitutional amendment.
That's totally fair to ask. What are the steps and what is our next step? Our very first step... I honestly think of myself right now, metaphorically. I mean, it's easier to say this since Gregory kind of loosely compared me to Moses. Those are big boots to fill. But so somewhat smaller, think of me as Paul Revere. Paul Revere did not single-handedly take on the British Navy and the British Army, right? What did Paul Revere do?
The alarm.
He raised the alarm. He raised the alarm. And sisters and brothers, I am very serious when I say what I am doing right now, step one, is raising the alarm. And what I'm doing is trying to travel across the country and share with folks our country has been hijacked and the court system is trying to legalize that hijacking. And they're wrong. And we can do something about it. So step one is to try to simply educate people about what's happening. And I want to say, Karen, are you still with us? Karen has already done one of the things that I've been asking people to do, which is write a letter to the editor about corporate personhood and move to amend. Do you know that letters to the editor are the second most widely read thing in the newspaper? The headlines in the front page is one, and second, letters to the editor. You can have so much influence on your fellow citizens by writing letters to the editor. Also, call into talk radio and make the point about corporate personhood and how the court system is hijacking our government by allowing corporations to claim constitutional rights. If we do that, then we're educating ever more people. The third thing that I'm asking you to do right now when you go home or tomorrow, I mean really immediately, take that URL, that www.movetoamend.org, and email family and friends who are not here and say, listen, this website really describes how corporate America has hijacked our government and a plan to actually get it back. Please do like I've done and sign up at movetoamend, and they'll only contact you every 3 to 4 weeks with ideas about how this movement is going. I guess the point I'm making is, like, that's A, B, C, D. But point one is to talk to each other. Talk to each other about and talk truthfully. Because I'll tell you, that's the very first step in any movement. To actually begin conversation. And Andre Lourdes, for those of you who may know that name, Andre Lourdes said the very first step is having unsanctioned, honest conversation with each other. I mean, there's a reason why the enslaved Africans were forbidden from being able to read and write. Right? I mean, that was punishable by death. Why? Because they didn't want them to talk to each other. They knew very well that the ability to talk to each other was a key component of being able to build a movement. So Fred, step one is to talk to each other in every single way that we can. Step two, and it's not that big of a request, I don't think, is to go to candidate forums across the community, and whether somebody's running for city council or state assembly or state senate or U.S. Congress, you ask them, do you believe that corporations are persons with constitutional rights? Two, would you be willing to support a constitutional amendment to make it clear that corporations do not have constitutional rights? And let them know that's a linchpin issue for me. Because if you're not right on that issue, you can't be right on anything else. That is, in the words of Labor's Untold Story, a which side are you on question. You know, because during that revolution of the 1910s and the 1920s, that was the refrain that labor activists asked workers to ask everyone. Which side are you on? Are you on the side of the worker, or are you on the side of the boss? And I think that this question of corporate personhood is even deeper because it asks, which side are you on? Are you on the side of we the people who create our own government, or are you on the side of the corporations which have hijacked our government from us? And here's the interesting thing. That question will cut across the old left-right dichotomy. That question will actually allow us to talk to Tea Party people in a way that I don't think the progressive left does a good job of. So point one, talk to each other. Point two is to begin to make political demands upon people seeking office. Step three, and this is a bit longer down the road, start going to your local Kiwanis Club, your local Optimist Club. This very congregation probably has a board of directors. Have this Unitarian Universalist Church actually pass a resolution supporting Move to Amend so you can stand with the other organizations, 500 and counting organizations that have actually taken the position, so that all of us can see that we're not alone, that actually more and more people are standing up. Because I'll tell you something, we're a bit like, have you ever seen those documentaries on the Serengeti Plains of Africa where all the antelope will be, they're down, they're eating grass, you know, and they're flipping their tails a little bit, and everything's peaceful. And over to the side here, you've got the lionesses going through the grass. And it's really worth pointing out that it's the lionesses who are doing all the work while the male lions, with their beautiful manes, are preening underneath the tree. Man, think about that. But the lioness, she and her compadres are here in the grass. And what's interesting is there'll be thousands and thousands of these antelope or these gazelle. And what you'll see is one of them will go like this. And then another one way over here will jump up. And another one. But then 1, 2, 5, 7, 9. But then all at once, boom, the entire crowd, herd just takes off running. Folks, I understand. You are one of the early aware people. In fact, I say, look to your left. Seriously, look around. Look to your left and your right. Look around at one another. You're all freaks. You, each and every one of you, are not normal. I mean, it's a Thursday evening. It's a beautiful night. You have come here to listen to me? You've never even heard of me. Right? I mean, and you know what? Thank you. Thank you for being a freak. Because you know who else? You know who else were freaks? The American revolutionaries. The abolitionists. The women's suffrage organizers. The trade unionists. The civil rights activists. You know, everybody who did the work to make this country a decent place was a freak like you. And I honestly believe, and like, this is like, I wish that you knew me well enough to know how sincere I am when I tell you, we are going to win. Just as surely as the revolutionaries, as the American suffrage, women's suffrage movement, as the trade union movement, as the civil rights movement, we are going to win because we are on the side of righteousness. And the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. said it well. The arc of the universe may be long, but it bends towards justice. But the thing is, Fred, we've got to do the work. And so point one, talk to each other. Point two, start putting pressure on people who are seeking office. Point three, start to use existing institutions to pass resolutions in support of move to amend. And part four, run for office yourself. Somebody in this crowd is already thinking, you know, I could probably do a better job on the... What city are we on, Gregor?
Melbourne.
I could do a better job on the Melbourne City Council than those idiots I see on television. Right? I mean, come on, have you seen these people? I haven't seen them, but I guarantee I know what happens. And there's at least 75% of them that are fools. Or that are on the take. Or both. So the and from city council, then run for county commissioner, and then run for state senate or state assembly, and ultimately for U.S. Congress, because that's what movements do. Movements that take themselves seriously get political, and they run for office. And then lastly, we'll culminate. See, the call for a constitutional amendment is our organizing call to show that we're serious. And it works for Gregory, for example. You know, he saw that immediately. He said, thank goodness somebody is actually organizing people with a plan and a strategy. But Fred, I took a long time on your question because it was the first question and it was, I think, the most important question. What, like, if you agree with me, then what's the plan? And I took this amount of time to answer that to really lay out for you that we at Move to Amend do have a plan, but we need your active participation. Number two. I told y'all that this would only work if you would remember your number.
I wrote my number.
Yeah, you're number six.
I know.
I wrote it down. Yeah, claim the space, brother.
And I agree with what you said about talking to each other. We need to be the media.
Yes.
Because we are not being served by our televisions or our radios or our newspapers or our magazines. So we must be the media and find out things like the fact that the United States Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has okayed torture and extraordinary rendition on the 7th of September, just a week ago.
Hold on. That's true. I want you to, in a nutshell, say that one more time. What did the Ninth Circuit do?
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals okayed torture and extraordinary rendition on a 6-5 vote.
So, the federal court system has said it is okay to torture in your names. Are you okay with that?
No.
I'm not. You know, part of this document, and John, I'm going to come back to you, but this whole thing in the Declaration of Independence says that the only government that is legitimate is the government that has the consent of the governed. Another way to think about what we're doing as a nonviolent revolution is to say, we do not consent. I do not consent to torture and extraordinary rendition being applied in my name. Sorry for the interruption, John.
No.
Please continue.
And the other thing that I would mention is it's not happening only in America. Parliament of Canada was shuttered by the Governor General on two occasions, which forbade the Parliament to sit. And by not sitting, they were unable to cast out Harper. And many social pieces of legislation were lost because of the shuttering funnel, and that had to come from the hand of the Queen. But there are other nations besides the United States that are being afflicted by this same force.
This force, by the way, I think it's time for us to really get serious, folks. It's time to be willing to say the F word.
Force.
Not that F word, you nasty people. Seriously, fascism. I think it's time for us to really take stock and recognize that we have an ever-creeping fascism going on in this country. And if we don't stand up and speak out, the grip will tighten. You know, one of the great Americans of all time, Frederick Douglass, once said it well. He said, "You show me the exact amount of injustice that a people are willing to tolerate, and I will show you the exact amount of injustice that the ruling elite will impose upon them. And this injustice will continue until it is resisted by words or deeds or blows or all." Another thing he said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. And I think that a big part of the problem, quite frankly, is too many good people, people like you, are not actually standing up and fighting hard enough. And I mean, myself too, I'm not trying to excuse myself one darn bit. I don't think that we've really taken ourselves seriously enough. You know, is it John?
Yes.
You know, John, I'm reminded of the great Texas politician Sam Rayburn, who once said in the 1950s, as an elected official, when I feel the heat, I always see the light. And frankly, it occurs to me that we haven't really been generating much heat in this country. And I say this delicately, but all of the energy and the enthusiasm around Barack Obama was just a trickle of what we need. Right? It was a good flicker, but it's not the flame that we need. We need a flame of righteous indignation and anger about torture. We need a blazing fire about empire and the fact that Iraqi children are being starved to death in our names. That ain't right. Number three. Yes, sir.
Yes, you gave a great history lesson here today. And I'd like to point out that, as a historian myself, I'd be very, very grateful and very, very good performance, I'd say, on your part.
It's political performance art.
But I'll tell you one thing.
Like preaching.
With the material that you presented here tonight would probably represent, I would say, about a week's worth of classroom material for a middle school or high school curriculum in a failing, in my opinion, a failing public school system that we have here. And the reason why I bring this up is because, as a historian, it took me, believe it or not, it took me 2 years before I actually found out exactly what happened in the Florida legislature in 2006. Under the last year that Jeb Bush was in office, it was the last part of the so-called education reform platform. And basically, it was the 2006 Florida Legislation Educational Act, which basically prevents it not only diminishes civics and history in public schools, but it changes the curriculum in which history was taught. And for example, if any education, right now under that law, if any teacher says anything sort of not in line with the official position, the chances of that teacher being reprimanded or even losing his or her job could be a possibility. And that not only hurts the teachers, it hurts the students as well. It's online. You can check it out. And I read a critical assessment of that by the AHA, the American Historical Association, criticizing that type of legislation. This is not only here in Florida, but I'm sure other states must have
Well,
as well. So I just want to commend you on the material that you presented here tonight. If you have any thoughts on that, please feel free.
Well, thank you, Tim. First of all, it always is flattering to me when a historian commends me on the presentation. So I'm flattered and acknowledge that. I also think it's really worth pointing out that even if somebody were to disagree with the narrative arc of what I've just presented, and I do kind of call this political performance art, and let's be honest, it ain't much different than preaching, is it, Gregory? Not much.
Not in this church.
not with this preacher. I saw him up there a little bit, and I said, man, if his hair was... if he had a different hair shape, that would be my papaw right up there, because you sound a lot like him. Except for you talked funny. But your words were very reminiscent. But Tim, I think that it's important to understand that even if you disagreed with what I say, I hope that we can all agree that I have the right to say it. And likewise, I think that's really important to understand that we as progressives have got to understand that we will fight to the death of what an individual's rights. So don't let them tell you that because you oppose corporate constitutional rights, that you don't support freedom and liberty. Because we do support individual rights and individual freedoms. And that includes, by the way, idiots like David Duke. An idiot like David Duke has the absolute freedom to be an idiot. You know? He does. And I am free to mock and ridicule him for being an idiot. Because that's what he is. He is a buffoon. And I will mock and ridicule him for that. But corporations do not have any rights at all. And so we have the absolute authority to govern economic institutions in this country. And we should. And I'm going to take your opportunity. So that's...
Yeah, my point is, this wouldn't have been discussed in any history class.
It wouldn't have been allowed to be discussed in a public history class. Yeah. Because the Florida legislature made it basically illegal. And speaking of the Florida legislature, that's the reason that I carry and have been carrying in my breast pocket the flyer for Flyer, the Florida Initiative for Electoral Reform. This is probably the most serious, comprehensive set of programs to make elections actually democratic in Florida than I have seen anywhere. I'm literally carrying it around and waving it about because I am urging you, if you care about elections in Florida and if you want to see Florida's elections actually be fair and democratic, listen to what they're calling for. And I think it's worth the solutions. End gerrymandering. Establish public financing. Establish instant runoff or ranked choice voting. Have fair ballot access. Have fair media access. Have fair debate access. This is the bare minimum. Regardless of who wins an election, if these bare things are not done, you can't even pretend like you've got a fair electoral process or a fair democratic system for electing representatives. You just can't. So, Timothy, thank you for the history component, but thank you also for underscoring and reminding us that what happens in the Florida legislature matters. Number four. Yes, sir.
Thanks, David. And I agree with everything you said. I just wanted to know, do you have a feel for how much support you're giving nationally? And are other states doing the same thing at this time?
Well, sir, what's your name, first name?
Bill.
Thank you. I almost feel like I've got plants that have been set up, but I just want to promise y'all that I have not asked for any of these questions in advance. Bill, I am happy to tell you that ABC and the Washington Post commissioned a poll after the Citizens United case, and they found that over 80% of the American people opposed this court's ruling in Citizens United, which is to say they opposed the doctrine of corporations claiming constitutional rights. That means, and then they broke it down, self-identified or registered Democrats opposed it by over 84%. Self-identified independents opposed it by over 82%. Self-identified Republicans opposed it by 72%. I have never, in the history of my social change work, I have never worked on a campaign or an issue where there was such broad support from the get-go. I mean, it cuts across political ideology. It cuts across party lines. I mean, we have huge and broad support already for this position. The second thing you ask is, what are other states doing? I can tell you, and I'm not looking for a pat on the head, but I'm on the road now one half to two-thirds of my life. Traveling the country just like this. I just did 5 days in Texas. I was on the road in Ohio for 10 days. I was in New Mexico for 3 days. I go back to California, sleep in my own bed for 4 days, and then go back out on the road in California. And even though it's my home state, I'll be 500 miles away, so I'm calling that on the road. You know what I mean? And so I guess what I'm getting at is, Bill, yes, other states are on the move. We are in very early stages. And again, I've never worked on something where there were so many people who were in agreement. And like, and for me, like the first time I saw this laid out this way, honestly, it was about 15 years ago. And it was, for me, what I will call a paradigm shift. I was in the audience at a presentation from a fellow named Richard Grossman, who went on to found the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, which is one of the groups that I now work with. There are eight of us. We're a think tank. And it changed the way I saw the world. And as a lawyer, I was a practicing lawyer, at the time I said, there it is. That's how they're doing it. That's how they've actually hijacked our government and how they've hijacked our legal system. So I'm not looking for a pat on the head about traveling so much. I'm not looking for a pat on the head that I've been at this for 15 years. Some people might say, well, Kyle, what's wrong with you? 15 years, you didn't get anywhere. To which I say, the Citizens United case has provided a kind of clarity to this. And no less a historian than Howard Zinn, who talked about, he said the entire history of the United States can be understood as efforts by groups of people to be legally defined as persons. He also said, just before he died, he commented on the Citizens United case. And he said, sadly, liberals will go apoplectic over this decision, claiming, oh no, the ruling elite has stolen our elections. Oh no, the ruling elites are using the court system to legitimize their theft. But in reality, the ruling elite have always stolen our elections. They have always used the court system to legitimize their theft. And Howard Zinn said, I hope this provides a moment of clarity. Number five. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Jeremy, and I want to say again, I disagree with everything you said tonight. I appreciate it you've come here. I guess my question is this. You know, if there are several other movements kind of on the same lines of what we're trying to do here, and agree that corporations do not have personhood, like, where I'm not sure what we're going to do is, say we do get this amendment through, and corporations can't put the corporation money into it. They're paying their executives $20, $40, $50 million, $100 million a year. And then those executives are taking that money, which is now their private money, and they have their own individual right to do what they want with that money and report it into the elections from their own pocket. You know, we see it right here in our state. Rick Scott, Jeff Green, see it in California. That's their money. They can do that. But how do we fight that? Because that's coming from the corporations.
So what's your name again?
Jeremy.
Thank you for that question, Jeremy, because I think that Jeremy has actually, like Fred asked, what do we do next? And I tried to lay it out. Jeremy says, are you going far enough? To which I say, not if you think that the only thing we're about is amending the Constitution. Because Jeremy's question provokes me to acknowledge something. As big as the constitutional amendment is, it's a tactic, not the goal. Our goal is, at Move to Amend, is nothing short than a nonviolent cultural revolution in this country. And Jeremy, when we get, not if, when we get to the point that we actually have created the political power and the shift that will amend the Constitution, it means that we will also have the political power to mandate full publicly funded elections. And we will take all private money out of elections and make it illegal for private money to go into an election at all. We'll also have the political power necessary to have instant runoff voting and proportional representation to guarantee the kind of pluralistic governing systems that we need and want in this country. We'll also have the political power necessary to say candidates for office have a guaranteed right to access to the airwaves, and they don't even have to pay for it because those are public airwaves and elections are public important. And therefore the public will hear from them. We'll also have the political power to say, if you are a ballot qualified candidate, you get to be participatory in the debate. And they won't be able to shut out Dennis Kucinich in the primary the way they did. And they, frankly, they won't be able to shut out David Cobb and the Green Party. Because in 2004, I was the only candidate calling for an end to the illegal, immoral, and unconstitutional wars in Iraq. I was the only candidate calling for an end to the Federal Reserve System and to create a democratic, publicly financed banking system. I was the only candidate calling for a dismantling of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. I was the only candidate calling for an end to No Child Left Behind, Tim, which is devastating public schools in this country. I was the only candidate calling for single-payer health care as a fundamental human right. And I'll tell you, Jeremy, I think that the reason that they don't want somebody like me actually talking to the American people is because they know that if millions of Americans hear somebody like me, they will join me. You can applaud that. Like, my ego is not tied up on this. I don't think that they'll join David Cobb. They've never heard of David Cobb. What I'm saying is, if somebody like me, with a little bit of passion and a little bit of courage, and is able to articulate in a comprehensive way the world that they want to live in, they will join. And so, Jeremy, back to your question. Does this go far enough? No. But this is a very concrete thing to say, come on, y'all, let's go for this. Because as we go for this, it means all of these other things are there. Think of it like this. If we're way back here and a constitutional amendment is here on this line, but next to it is publicly financed elections and access to the debates and single-payer health care and Federal Reserve dismantling, and we're back here struggling for it, don't you see that when the movement gets to the place where we got the constitutional amendment, all the rest of it is available to us too? See what I mean? So that's what I'm getting at, Jeremy. It's like, first of all, thank you for the provocative question. You know, like, are we going far enough? No. Not if all we're ever asking for is one thing. But we're not really asking for one thing. What we're calling for is a nonviolent revolution that will give us all of the things that we deserve. Number six.
Politically, I'm a syndicalist.
What that means is he's an anarchist, y'all.
No, I'm not. What is a syndicalist?
It's a unionist.
No, a syndicalist means that the workers own the businesses. And like in Sweden, they have a special tax that goes into a fund to buy the businesses for the workers, with an eventual goal in that country that the workers will own all the businesses. But then...
No, it's not at all. It's the opposite of.
But what should you, you know, another thing is, where can we go? You know, look, people will say, well, oh, we'll never get this done or something, you know? But take, for instance, in Germany, by law, you have seven people on the board of directors of a corporation, three for management, three for labor, and then they pick the seventh person. So labor and management, like all German corporations, have equal, you know, I love it. Then another thing, how about a layperson appointed to the Supreme Court?
I like it.
Well, the reason I say that is the Supreme Court, by their position, are the experts on the Constitution.
So they say.
But I mean by they are. By the power they have, right? They only agree 40% of the time. So if you look at that, 40% of the time, if it was only 90, it'd scare the hell out of me. Because you're talking about people dying. I mean, you like take for instance, let's say you were convicted of murder. Mm-hmm. It takes 12 people on the jury to convict you, right?
Unanimously, in fact.
Right, send you to kill you, right? What does it take on the Supreme Court?
Five.
Right. You know? In other words, they don't even need, you know, unanimous.
Not even unanimous. It's not even, they don't even need a supermajority. A bare majority will get her done.
But when you're looking at only 40% of the time, and these, by their positions, are the experts on the Constitution. And they only agree 40% of the time. You know? I mean, I can see so many things wrong. You know, but then I look at other countries. Take, for instance, in Sweden. I brought it up. But in Sweden, they used to have a law that the union steward could close down everything that was unsafe and everybody could pay for it fixed. And that can't be fair. So they changed it. Any worker in Sweden can close anything down that's unsafe and everybody gets paid until it gets fixed.
And by the way, Sweden has one of the lowest worker mortality rates in the industrialized world. I wonder if it's because of the law that Warren is describing.
But what has happened, why And I blame it on unions in the United States. Because the unions in the United States thought the strike was the ultimate weapon. You know, there were unions that were against the New Deal. They were against minimum wage. They were against overtime pay. Why would anybody join a union if the government's going to give us this stuff? And then dumb Europeans form labor parties. You know? So what happens? Do you negotiate anywhere in industrial Europe for health care? No.
Don't need to.
Right. Vacations. Everybody gets, like Germany, 30-day paid vacations, 18 paid holidays.
So hold on. Did you hear what he said? 30 days in Germany you get as a guaranteed paid vacation by law. Doesn't matter if you're a member of the union or not. That's mandated legislatively. I think Warren has really captured, and I know he's a trade unionist because we were talking earlier, and I thought it was funny, you know, when he said syndicalist, really what that means is economic democracy. The people who actually do the work have the actual power and authority to make the decisions of that shop. That's actually what that means. And if you take that idea of having the power at the factory, and then you say, well, what if with that power, we're actually going to translate it into political power and all the rest of society and how it operates, you have a completely different mindset. And I think, like, in France, for example, like, those folks will shut the country down if and when there is any threat to their sixth week of vacation. I mean, I just think it's a different mindset. And I do agree with Warren that the problem, and I say this as a trade unionist myself, unions in this country made a profound tactical error when all they did was focus on trying to exercise their power by strikes or on union shops and didn't understand the need to politicize their power across society.
Well, I mean, another thing, my wife is German. I met her scuba diving in Mario, as a widower. In fact, she's in Germany right now visiting her family. She has one son and three grandchildren. You know what she gets? Or what he, what the family gets? They get 250 euros a year, I mean a month, for the first child, 250 euros a month for the second child, and 450 euros a month for the third child until they turn 18. They're getting over $1,000 a month.
I wanted to say something. You know, I used to live in Germany, I used to live in Europe, and they don't spend their money on war. You know, they pay a lot of taxes in there. Where do their taxes go? Where does the money go? It goes towards social, it goes towards the people. That's another thing in this country that we need to think about. Okay, what the people that are in government, the demands, not only about certain laws, but what do they do with that money? What kind of twiddle-dee-twiddle-dum kind of stuff is going on?
Here's a question for you, Jane. Where was the...
Two things, and then I'll shut up.
Please, I'm going to hold you to that.
Remember what Milton Friedman said? Capitalism has no social responsibility. The only responsibility it has is to maximize profits for its investors. So what's the balance? It should be the government. We did get stuff passed, you know, before we got the Environmental Protection Agency. You remember when the Detroit River caught on fire? Because they just dumped that stuff in it, you know? But we don't, the people don't have the power here that they have in Europe, you know? I mean, free education.
We don't take the power.
We don't exercise.
You look at free education. Take, for instance, all European industrial nations have free education. Denmark, though, you get an extra 400 euros a month while you're going to college. So they're paying you like $500 a month to go to college, plus the college is free. You know?
Warren, I'm going to hold you to your...
I'm quiet. I'm sitting down.
No, I'm going to be like that.
Yeah.
But I did want to actually pick up on Gregory's point, because when you said that people don't have the power, Gregory, you said...
We don't take the power.
We don't take the power.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. Like, really, folks... Here is a big thing, and I have to actually give credit to others. For example, David Corton, and there was a great Zen master, I've forgotten her name, it'll come to me, but she said, we the people are actually far more powerful than we even dare to imagine. And I think that that's really important, that the reality is we've got so much more power than we actually exercise. You know, again, Howard Zinn talks about the fact that if we're going to have a successful revolution, we don't actually need just the oppressed to actually rise up. The key to the next revolution will be the guardian class. You know, people like us who are in more or less middle America who are propping up the rest of this system. And we're propping it up in a number of ways, by acquiescing to the fascism that we see happening all around us and not speaking up. We acquiesce to this by continuing to vote for candidates who are not supporting our principles and values. We are acquiescing in so many different ways. And I think it's important for us to actually exercise our power collectively, and we can change the world. And Jane, we talked about Germany a little bit. There's something else that's interesting about Germany politically that I think is interesting. What's that? It's the birthplace of what?
Oh, the Green Party.
I'm just going to point out to you that the reality is that the idea of saying that ecology and social justice and grassroots democracy and a commitment to peace and nonviolence is a way to make social change, that's the core of Green Party principles and values. I'm not going to turn this into a Green Party advertisement here, but I am going to just educate you on what the Green Party stands for and ask yourself, do the candidates that you're voting for reflect your own values? Because if they don't, stop voting for them. So let's do another round, and I'm going to ask first, if you haven't asked a question, raise your hand if you want to, and this will be the last one, so if you've been waiting, here's your chance. Number one, sir, you are number two. Sir, you are number three. And if you've already asked a question, you can go again. Tim, you'll be number four. So those are the last four, and then I will, by the way, I will personally stick around and answer more questions, because I know some people don't like to talk publicly. Thanks for coming out, ma'am. Number one, sister.
It's funny, I came here today when we were working in the RE room. I opened the door and I'm like, okay, I didn't see you. I don't believe in coincidence, though. I'm very glad I'm here tonight, and this was very enjoyable. Thank you. But you did first get something with your history lesson there. And that helped me out here a little bit, because you mentioned civil rights.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the union stuff with the 30s and the 20s and the 30s. Women voting and suffrage,
abolition of slavery.
Yes, there's always one thing I can't pronounce. I don't know what that is. And the founding of America, Unitarians and Universalists have had a hand in all of it.
That is true.
So I just wanted to point that out.
You know what? Thank you for that. And I will happily stand corrected, and in fact, oftentimes I do, and shame on me for not acknowledging. Look, it's really worth pointing out too, and I'll just lay it out like this. On this tour of Florida, 90% of the presentations I'm doing are in Unitarian Universalist congregations. So thank you. So thank you. And I got to tell you, as the grandson of a Baptist preacher, if there were more churches like this, I might come to more churches. I'm just saying, I feel a lot more comfortable in these kinds of churches than any other one. Number two?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I'm Bob Cerruti, and you've shown that history always refers to the past. Sometimes we don't give enough to science fiction, which points out what happens in the future. I can mention two books. One is Alfred Bester's Stars My Destination. The other is Kurt Vonnegut's Utopia 14. And they both kind of show that the United States of America gets replaced by the United Corporations of America. And the other thing is, I'm a very large advocate of education. And you mentioned No Child Left Behind. I see that that's been replaced by Race to the Top. How do you feel about that?
Listen, I think that is an outrageous way to actually describe the whole phenomenon. I mean, you know, since we're going to talk about education, let's just be clear. The most important thing that any human child learns how to do is how to walk and how to talk. And in our public school system, the first thing they're taught, sit down and shut up. And I got to tell you, that I think really underscores the problem. Because, yes, No Child Left Behind is devastating public education. But if we go even deeper, don't we really want an educational system where systematically the idea is to encourage critical thinking and to produce citizens who are able to think critically and assert themselves in a peaceful manner, but really advocate for their views and what they believe so that they can help to shape the society in which they live? That's the kind of education system that I want, and what I see is our current system is actually designed intentionally to create obedient workers, to create a group of people who are passive, who are not capable of even articulating their demands, even if they can come to understand what they were. So the idea of this race to the top, No Child Left Behind, no. I'm going to reject that whole thing. Tell me your name. I'm sorry.
Bob.
Bob, what I'll say is I want to reject that whole thing and say, if we're really serious about nonviolent revolution, and that means we turn the thing upside down and say, let's start from scratch for our educational system, let's start from scratch and actually say, first, every child gets loved and cuddled and celebrated when she or he walks in. And then secondly, that child is challenged, really challenged, to be the best that she or he can be. And third, that child is taught to sharpen her or his critical thinking to the best of their ability. And we're not going to coddle them, and we're not going to give them all A's just for walking through the door, but neither are we going to blindly pass them all. We're going to allow every child to actualize, to actually develop their skills to the best of their ability, so that by the time they finish through that project, they're each marching out proud of themselves for developing their own skills to the very best of their ability, knowing that then when they go out, they are expected to be fully participatory members of our society in a democratic republic. You know, Bob, that I think is different than either No Child Left Behind or Race to the Top. 1, 2, 3. Number 4. I think you're 5.
No.
I
was 3.
Oh, 3. I'm sorry, 3. You're right. Good job, Max. Now, I told you, I made a big deal. This will only work if you remember your numbers and if I remember to count.
Our government, of course, operates hand in hand with our political system.
Yes.
And I think we'll all agree that our political system is at fault for so many of our ills. And it's populated by people who are put in office by the special interests, of course. The incumbents can't be ousted from office because they're fueled by the special interests, and other peoples cannot make it into office because they don't have that funding. Now, what I want to get at is that now in Congress, there is the FINA bill, Fair Elections Now Act, and I believe that there's something like 150 co-sponsors for that. Do you believe that there is a chance for that ever being enacted, and what will that do to cure some of these ills that we've been talking about?
So, what, Bob?
Bill.
Yeah, what Bill is describing is it is the Fair Elections Now Act, and in effect, Fred, it is not complete, fully publicly financed elections for Congress, but a really good start at it. And there are, I think, now 200 sponsors, because the numbers keep going up and up and up, and we're dangerously close to actually getting it passed. I think that the Disclosure Act is going to pass in this election cycle, and nobody thought it would. And I think that there is a very good chance that we can get the FINA bill passed into law, and if and when we do, it will change the ability to elect people to office at the congressional level. And I say that because I know what happens when states enact publicly financed elections. I'm going to put Fred on the spot. I haven't told him I was going to do this. Fred, can you tell me what state was the first state to pass fully publicly financed elections?
It was Maine.
Maine. And Fred, can you tell me how many waitresses there are in the Maine legislature?
A few. I don't know the number.
There's one. There are no other waitresses in any other state legislature. There are also several electricians. There are several plumbers. There is a house painter. I mean, the point I'm making, Bill, is that when you have publicly financed elections, different kinds of people end up being able to be elected. And do you think that a waitress might have a different worldview than a rich lawyer? You know, do we think that working class people who work day in and day out have a different view about, I don't know, minimum wage or health care? Right? I mean, the point I'm making is that if you ask me, will it make a difference? Of course it'll make a difference. I think it's one of those things that is a rule changer. It'll make a huge difference. Number four.
Just a follow-up to this. People should be aware that Amendment 1 in the general election, in the Florida election, proposes to eliminate the poorly constructed public financing law that we have now. So Florida is actually going
backwards.
Reverse.
So is Amendment 1 something that you support or not? Because I know that language... Are you all not... Are you punting?
So I'm going to vote against Amendment 1, but I'm not going around lobbying for it because the legislation, the law that we have now is not... does not promote the kind of diversity in candidates, does not allow poorly financed candidates to run. You got to be rich to take advantage
gotcha.
Of the Florida campaign.
I will tell you this. So that Amendment 1 is lukewarm at best. Bill's not advocating one way or the other, but he's sharing with us how he's going to vote. I'll take this opportunity to say, I do think on your ballot in November, y'all have got a huge opportunity. That's Amendment 4. That's big. You've got the opportunity to actually claim the power to approve or, more importantly, disapprove of any effort by a developer to come in and change your general plan. This is about the most clear expression of democratic power that I've seen a state exercise literally in 10 years. And I'm a little bit surprised, actually, that Amendment 4 didn't come up in this conversation earlier. So allow me, if I can, Bill, to kind of hijack your space here on Amendment 1 and say Amendment 4 is the real deal, y'all. Y'all, I mean, I'm really advocating in support of Amendment 4, and I encourage you to tell your family and your friends and your neighbors how important it is, because guess what? They're going to be millions of dollars of developer money making lies and propaganda on the airwaves and the radio airwaves to try to convince you to vote against your own self-interest. Amendment 4 empowers you, pure and simple. And speaking of 4, number 4.
Mr. Cobb, as you know, I've done a lot of reading last 6 years, and I'll have to say that one of the books that I've come across in my studies was has to do with basically absolute power, and I guess if you call it, I guess the terminology in that is something called absolutism. And one of the most fascinating books, and this isn't just corporate power, but it's total power here in the United States. I'm talking about probably the most fascinating book I read was a book called Don't Start the Revolution Without Me. Something that kind of you're talking about here tonight, too, with Jesse Ventura. He's the author in it. And in that book, the part that I didn't know that really totally knocked me off my chair was the fact that when he's an independent, third-party candidate, something that, you probably advocate, and a lot of people here in the congregation and in the country and everything like that. He describes a scenario that actually happened to him because he was not part of the Republican-Democrat duopoly. About a week after he was elected to office, he got an uninvited visit by 14 members of the CIA that just went down to his basement talking room or conference room, made themselves at home. And they started asking him, he says, well, I don't know your names, and you don't know my names. And just a few of them would actually give him their names during the introduction. It was a power play. The CIA is not supposed to have any type of operations in the United States, according to their original charter back in, when they were formed under the Truman administration back in 1947, thereabouts. So he was bullied.
into, well, you get, you know, into a sense of powerlessness, which is called mana. If any elected official is not a Republican or a Democrat, he holds office state, this is in every state in the Union now, they will get a visit from the CIA. Tell me about that.
Well, I actually don't know about that. I don't know if that's true or not, but I can tell you what I do know is true for a fact. Okay, I don't disagree. I'm not saying it didn't happen to him. I say I don't know anything about it, so I can't really comment upon about a CIA visit. I would recommend the book because I think Justice Ventura is a great case study. Let me actually tell you a little bit, if I can, about Justice Ventura, what I do know. But I do know that when he ran for governor as an independent, or actually a member of a third party, when he was first running, he was polling at about 4 to 5%. He was allowed to participate in the debates, and he made so much sense that his support doubled to about 8 to 9% from the participation in one debate alone, one statewide television debate, his support doubled. He was allowed to participate in the second debate. And do you know what happened there? His support doubled again because he continued to make sense. And just by hearing him in a televised debate, Minnesotans started to say, well, wait a minute. You know, I actually think that this does make sense. I kind of like the straight talking that he's doing here. He was allowed to participate in the third debate. And what happened?
He won the election.
He won the election. Literally, he was outspent over 10 to 1 by the Democrat and the Republican. He literally, his entire campaign can be traced to merely his ability to have three opportunities to speak to the voters of Minnesota. And he was even speaking through a highly moderated forum. He didn't get 30 minutes to just say, sisters and brothers of Minnesota, let me talk to you. He was literally a participant with the Democrat and the Republican, and he made more sense. So this is the reason why I'm such a fan of Flyer, because they're not just talking about publicly financed elections and instant runoff voting, both of which I support. They're also talking about access to the debates and access to the ballot, and understanding that regardless, if we're going to have a fair and democratic system, the people really have to be able to hear from candidates. So I would recommend, tell us the name of the book again.
Don't Start the Revolution Without Me.
I mean, look, just on the basis of the title alone, I think I'm going to go get it. But I also do think, really and for true, the Jesse Ventura story of a maverick uprising, and he and I don't agree on so many issues, but the strength and the power of his conviction cannot be questioned. His patriotism cannot be questioned. And so to me, what I'm urging people to do, again, if you're going to stay in the Democratic Party, hook up with Progressive Democrats of America. I personally have joined the Green Party and would encourage you, Jane is a member of the Green Party, actually the co-chair of the Green Party of Florida. If you're interested in what the Green Party stands for or what the Green Party is up to in this state, go and talk to Chain. But at the end of the day, y'all, you have to get involved in elections. Because if you want systemic change in this country in a nonviolent way, the ballot box is the key. Thank you so much. Let's stick around. Thank you, Reverend, for allowing me this opportunity. Thank you very much. Thank you. Hey, I'm coming back to Florida in 2011. Maybe y'all get Gregory to invite me back again. All right, I'll stick around. Hey, Gregory.